Keeping Democracy Alive with Bert Cohen.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
It happened 100 years ago today, November 2nd, 1917. During this week, Palestinians and Zionists around the world will be marking each in their own way 100 years since the historic Balfour Declaration was issued. The declaration turned the Zionist aim of establishing a Jewish state in Palestine into a reality when Britain publicly pledged to establish, quote, a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. The pledge is generally viewed as one of the main catalysts of the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948, and the conflict that ensued with the Zionist State of Israel. It is regarded as one of the most controversial and contested documents in the modern history of the Arab world and has puzzled historians for decades. Was it by its nature imperialist? Was it racist? Or was it a moment too long in coming whereby the so-called people without a land finally got a land of their own? With us today to talk about what the Balfour Declaration means in the history of the Middle East is Dan Freeman Malloy. Dan, thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Happy to be here.
Dan Freeman Malloy is an activist and writer based in Montreal. He holds a PhD from the University of Exeter, completed through its European Center for Palestine Studies. I remember back in religious school hearing about the great Balfour Declaration and hearing about, as I said, a people without a land gaining a land without people. Of course, that was quite inaccurate. The Jewish people, also known as the people Israel, certainly had not had a chunk of land, a nation to call their own, and had been a diaspora spread throughout the world for a very long time. But of course, Palestine was not exactly a land without people. So let's start with definitions. What is the Balfour Declaration? Why is it significant to this day? What did it actually say?
Well, the Balfour Declaration is a relatively short letter in effect that was sent on the 2nd of November through to the Zionist Federation of Great Britain and Ireland by the British Foreign Secretary at the time, Lord Arthur Balfour. And it said that, I'll just read the whole thing, it's not so long, His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. And then with two provisos, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. And those were sort of the two major contradictions of this idea of creating a Jewish homeland in Palestine, namely, what does that mean for Jews elsewhere? And especially, what of these existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, a very euphemistic designation for the vast majority non-Jewish Palestinian indigenous Arab population of the country. A key point to remember is that this wasn't just a British declaration. I mean, on a diplomatic level, it did just come from Britain. But we're also marking 100 years since Britain occupied Palestine. So when the Balfour Declaration was issued, British troops were massed outside Gaza City. By the time it was published a week later in the press, British troops held Gaza, and by the end of 1917, British troops had occupied Jerusalem and the entirety of Palestine. So when we're looking back to what this has meant for the fate of Palestine and for the horrific crisis that we continue to see unfold, we have to remember that it wasn't just this declaration, but it was also 3 decades, in effect, of British occupation of Palestine that began in 1917.
And how, let's look at that British occupation of Palestine. 1917 certainly saw the British Empire in the midst of a very aggressive war between empires. Back then it was known as the Great War, now it's known as the First World War. There were the British, the French, German, Austro-Hungarian, and the Russian. And to the east, south of Russia, was the Ottoman Empire, called at the time, derisively, the sick man of Europe. Please tell us the context from which the Balfour Declaration came into being with regard to the sick man of Europe, the Ottoman Empire, and these warring empires in 1917, which had been at war for about 3 years by then.
Yes, yeah, certainly the immediate context was the First World War, but a little more broadly as well. I think we need to see this as part of a wider process of European imperial expansion. In the 19th century, Britain established itself as the principal imperial power in the world, and it was really the extension of the British Empire across the Middle East during the First World War was one of the latest acquisitions of new Afro-Asian territory by the British Empire. So people are maybe familiar with, in the late 19th century, the scramble for Africa that saw European powers divide amongst themselves African territories. And it was an extension of a very similar process to the Middle East that happened with the First World War. So there was secret diplomacy between the French and the British about how Middle Eastern territories might be divided among themselves. And there was this big shift. So for centuries, much of the Middle East had been controlled by the Ottoman Empire.
Right.
For reasons of inter-imperial rivalry, it was decided by the Allies around it was a sort of gradual process, but effectively, Turkey and the Ottoman Empire allied themselves with Germany. And though it had long been British policy to sort of maintain sovereignty of the Ottoman Empire, at least formally, and build British influence within it, there was a 180-degree turn, and the decision to dismantle the Ottoman Empire and bring Middle Eastern territory directly into the British sphere of influence. And it was in that context that Britain took Palestine and decided to hold it.
Hmm. And as I understand, Britain, you know, they had their jewel in the crown, India, British India. They wanted to make sure that they had an overland route between England and India, and certainly the Ottoman Empire was right there in the way of that. So that it must have added to the importance of having some control over or through, at least through, that territory. And certainly...
The relationship between the Ottoman Empire and the British Empire hadn't historically been just consistently antagonistic. So, for example, the first major British push into the Arab world was its occupation of Egypt. I mean, the first direct territorial occupation in 1882. And it was the nature of that occupation, oddly, that it was carried out, a huge British troop presence, effective British control. But formally, Egypt even was then under the sovereignty of the Ottoman Empire. So it wasn't as if the Ottoman Empire, until the early 20th century realignments, was seen as this kind of impediment necessarily to British control. But when these territories became the site of intense inter-imperial contestation, India was a factor for British administrators in Egypt. Some saw Palestine as potentially an eastern flank, which it would be useful to hold. There were a wide range of imperial calculations, as well as sort of more symbolic calculations on just the level of British wartime propaganda.
Mm.
And indeed, there's a complicated web of factors that sort of resulted in this decision to pursue the Jewish national home policy.
Mm-hmm.
But as you say, the context was one of a European power imposing its will on yet another external territory.
We've seen that so many times, imperialism. You know, I don't like imperialism. What can I tell you? And Zionism existed, certainly before the Balfour Declaration was declared and the First World War. What was the status of Zionism as the Balfour Declaration came into being?
Well, and I mean, your wider point on empire maybe should just be used to underscore why it's so important to talk about this. The crisis we see in Palestine, in some sense, does, of course, result from Zionism and this effort to create a Jewish state with a Jewish majority in a country with an overwhelmingly non-Jewish native majority. And that's had to involve a combination of expulsion and confinement and occupation and repression. That having been said, the capacity of the Zionist movement and of the Israeli state to do what it's done has derived from imperial support. For U.S. listeners, the fact that since 1967, the United States has been responsible for allowing Israel to expand itself territorially and to maintain its regional position is an important fact. But similarly, it was really a huge and invaluable boost to Zionist fortunes that they got in the form of the Balfour Declaration. Prior to World War I, something like 1% of Jews across the world had signified their affiliation with the World Zionist Organization. It was precisely Britain's occupation of Palestine and its declaration of support for Zionism that gave this enormous international momentum to the Zionist movement, and also gave to the Zionist movement for the first time legal standing in Palestine once the British occupation was and British rule was sort of regularized through the League of Nations and a British mandate for Palestine. So when we look at this history, we, especially those of us in the West, need to keep our eyes on the fact that it has been Western powers that have empowered the Zionist movement and allowed it to carry out what it's carried out.
If you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Live, Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is Dan Freeman Malloy, and we're talking about the 100th anniversary, November 2nd, 1917, of the Balfour Declaration, and what it means back then, what it meant back then, and what it means today. And I do find it fascinating that, at least here in America, the most ultra-Orthodox Jews do not recognize the state of Israel as being a Jewish state. They say that, you know, according to the Bible, or the text that they read, that could only come to us legitimately through the hand of God. This was through the hand of Britain, which is not exactly the same thing. Please tell us how, Dan, as you say, it was British imperialism that propelled the Zionist movement onto the world stage. And as you mentioned, it's a very complex web. The whole First World War was nothing but a complex web. Were the Brits seeking support from Zionists for their war effort? Is that what it was? Did they want Zionists around the world to help them with their war effort? Was that part of their aim behind the declaration?
Just first, I'll turn to that in a moment, but to pick up on a point that you made, I'm personally no theologian, but for people who are interested in that fact, the sort of way in which Zionism was really external to the Jewish religious tradition, there is actually an academic here in Montreal, Yaakov Rabkin, who's written a book that goes through, again, the striking distance and disjuncture between Jewish religious traditions and the Zionist movement in Israeli state as they've developed, and really picks apart this idea that in any meaningful sense, Israel is a Jewish state. So again, Yaakov Rabkin has published a book through Pluto Press that listeners could look to if they're interested in that point.
And what's the title of it?
But again, what's that?
What's the title of that book?
You know, it was translated from French. It's Comprendre l'État d'Israël, Understanding the State of Israel in French. But Yaakov Rabkin is the
Rabkin
author, and I believe it's just Understanding Israel in...
All right. Well, thank you for that.
In English, but I'm forgetting the English title.
That's okay. Well, as you were saying, go on, please.
Well, where then did the template come from for the Zionist movement? And I don't mean to oversimplify, but a major source of inspiration was the Anglo-American colonial tradition. This idea of settling overseas territories to solve Europe's problems was a very standard one for powerful forces in countries like Britain or the United States or Canada. And I think when you look to a lot of the people who were supporting the Zionist idea in Britain at the time of the First World War and after, you have a real reliance on the experience with countries like Canada and countries like Australia, with other settler colonial countries that were established abroad, and this idea, oh, why can't we sort of replicate that success in Palestine? Now, again, there's just a wide range of factors that went into making this seem compelling to the right British officials at the right time. A major factor, there was, on the one hand, just this strategic line geopolitically. So settler colonialism in British imperial thinking had long been a means of creating allies on the imperial frontier that are linked with the empire and sort of help extend its reach across the globe.
Yep.
And those sort of strategic arguments, as concerns India, as concerns Egypt, as concerns geopolitical rivalry generally, were voiced by different British officials. Another issue was that another theme within the British imperial tradition had been that, and this applied in the U.S. as well, it's when we have problems at home, one way that we can sort of solve them is by settling the troublesome elements at home on the imperial frontier. And it had been a big feature of British colonialism in South Africa and New Zealand and Canada, elsewhere, this idea that the contradictions that are created by industrial capitalism in Britain can be eased by emigration of the poor to the imperial frontier. In the United States, there was a very influential, I believe, early 20th century historian, Frederick Jackson Turner, who made a similar safety valve idea of settlement. Mm-hmm. This idea that we don't have to worry so much in the United States about social disruption and rebellion because we're able to channel those energies historically into the settlement of the West. And this idea that we have this problem with these Eastern European Jews coming to Western countries, we have this European Jewish crisis, why not solve it through overseas settlement? And the idea of solving Europe's Jewish problem through settlement in Palestine was part and parcel of a wider array of proposals to solve the Jewish problem through settlement. So the text that launched largely the Zionist movement in the late 19th century, Theodore Herzl's The Jewish State, put Argentina and Palestine on essentially equal footing as two possible sites for overseas settlement of Jews. In Canada, there were efforts to settle Jews in Western territories where indigenous and Métis communities still challenged the state. And Britain tried to pursue, in the early 20th century, in what's now Kenya, a project of Jewish settlement in affiliation with the World Zionist Organization. So there, as was usually the case for British settler colonialism, there were two factors that worked together. One, this idea that settlers linked to the empire abroad could be imperial allies, and also the idea that that could then be an outlet to channel people that you didn't really want in the home country.
Whoa. And I picked up a quote recently going along with that from more recent years, but it relates to that. The national director of the Anti-Defamation League, which is, you know, protecting Jews from prejudice and hate crimes, the national director of the Anti-Defamation League, Abe Foxman, one of the most well-known figures in the fight against anti-Semitism, after the terrorist acts against the Jews in France just a few years ago, addressed the battle between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and leaders of European countries over whether the Jews should move to Israel or stay in their diaspora homelands. Foxman, this head of the anti-Semitic group, stated that Jewish departure from Europe would be a, quote, posthumous victory for Hitler and would fulfill his Judenrein, Jewish land, vision. Tell us, please, about anti-Semitism in England at the time of the Balfour Declaration and how much it may have been a factor in the Balfour Declaration. It seems like it served a whole bunch of different purposes.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a tricky thing. I mean, Foxman, one needs to treat with caution because he's also definitely part of a school of thought that without anything like legitimate grounds, attacks people who are concerned about Palestinian rights as anti-Semitic. So he's this category of supporter of Israel that's very torn, because here is the contradiction. The idea of Zionism was part and parcel of this idea of sort of homogenous nation states, this idea that each people should have their own soil in a very sort of singular and exclusionary way. And there's a long history then of convergence between European anti-Semitism and Zionism, for the very simple reason that there were definitely European anti-Semites who were willing to go along with this idea that, yes, Jews should have a country in Palestine, which shows that Jews have a country and they don't belong in Britain, in France, in Poland, in Germany,
right,
etc.
Right.
So the tricky thing is that, and the Balfour Declaration tried to identify these two problems, but they're two enduring problems. Does the idea of an exclusively Jewish state jeopardize the rights of Jews abroad in other countries who want to call those other countries home,
yes,
as well as the indigenous Palestinian population? The contradiction for people like Foxman is they're very, very sensitive to the idea that the rights of Jews in the West should be infringed upon, which is actually an implication of strict Orthodox Zionist thinking. They, on the other hand, are very willing to go along with the violation of Palestinian rights. And this is similarly what we saw in sort of World War I Britain, where you have some of the most virulent anti-Semites who, when talking about Jews in Britain, will invoke all sorts of anti-Semitic tropes,
mm-hmm,
but then are very happy to say, one, yes, this is a way of solving the Jewish question in Europe so we can sort of export the troublesome Jews to
mm-hmm
the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other hand, Jews in the Middle East, in relation to Arabs, seem to us Western, so can sort of be a Western outpost. And it's this
uh-huh
very contradictory idea that these Jews who were considered insufficiently white and insufficiently Western to be absorbed into European civilization, nonetheless can serve as its sort of representative if they're willing to leave the continent.
Yeah, I must say, I did find it rather offensive when Netanyahu was suggesting that, you know, because of the terrorist acts in France, that the Jews just go to Israel. And I just think that's the wrong direction to go in, and just is harmful in so many ways. If you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Alive, Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is Dan Freeman Malloy. We're talking about the 100th anniversary today, November 2nd, of the Balfour Declaration, which mandated a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. And we'll talk about many different aspects of it, like what a mandate is, etc. But most wars require some outrageous incident to gin up public support for going to war, to justify a march to war of the young men of that country. One thinks of Fort Sumter and the war against Southern independence, and more recently, the non-existent alleged incident in the Gulf of Tonkin, which created the Vietnam War. But to a European public, which had experienced peace for nearly 50 years, as you call it, quote, a manipulation of atrocity stories, end of quote, was needed. You write of something called the Bryce Report about alleged German atrocities in Belgium. I remember hearing about some of those. What were those? And who was this Bryce? And in what ways was he, as you say, a pioneer of the kind of democracy that Britain helped Israel bring to the Middle East?
Well, this is a really important, I think, element when we think about state strategy. I mean, it's sometimes simpler to think about imperialism and the strategy of states in terms of dividing up territories and what resources do you want and what geopolitical advantage do you want. But it's very important also for imperial states to be able to maintain support for imperial policies. Of course, in the Vietnam War, this was a critical issue where the strength eventually of the anti-war movement meant that certain U.S. offensives had to be called off or tempered because they were concerned not only about Vietnamese resistance, but also about what would happen in U.S. streets, about rioting, about whether there would be enough U.S. security forces to maintain control in the U.S. faced with the outrages of U.S. forces in Vietnam. That tradition of imperial propaganda, it took a real turn for almost the worse or the more intensive during the First World War. The First World War was a watershed moment for state propaganda. There's lots of good research on this, and the U.S. was also caught up in it as well as Europe. But essentially, there was this effort to enlist intellectuals and writers from across Britain and in allied states to participate in making the war seem like a very glorious effort to both undermine enemy morale and boost morale at home, to make it seem as if justice marched alongside British troops.
Yeah.
This was a wide-ranging effort. I mentioned, indeed, the Bryce Report, which was this sensationalized account of German atrocities against Belgians. But there was it was really just this wide-ranging, institutionalized propaganda effort, both in Britain and in the United States as well, as a major center. I came across this quote that I find amusing enough and was interesting. Upton St. Clair, the famous American writer, was so incensed at how British propagandists and their allies in the United States had tricked him into becoming an enthusiastic supporter of World War I in 1917 that he wrote, and I'll quote, "I'm one of 110 million suckers who swallowed the hook of the British official propaganda conducted by an eminent bourgeois novelist, Gilbert Parker, who was afterwards knighted for what he did to me. Now he grins at me behind the shelter of his title, and my only recourse is to call upon the workers of Britain to wipe out that title and the system of caste banditry upon which it rests," wrote Upton St. Clair, as one sort of just indication in the 1920s of the bitterness of many Americans who realized they'd been fooled by a propaganda effort enticing them to support Allied war aims on the grounds of just sort of like fanciful propaganda stories.
Yeah.
So there were many aspects of this propaganda. And as the British looked to conquer territory in the Middle East, the idea of Palestine and the Holy Land was a really powerful symbol.
Ah.
It invoked the Crusades. You had, you know, British magazines printing pictures of old English crusaders like Richard the Lionheart looking over Jerusalem, which was now under British control, saying, "Finally, my dream fulfilled." And this sort of idea of a European holy war was powerful. The tricky thing for Britain was that if crusading imagery was the order of the day, their main rival, France, had as strong a claim to Palestine and probably a stronger claim than did Britain. And a major function of support for Zionism was to give Britain a reason to hold Palestine. It was precisely as the guardian of this Jewish national home policy that Britain justified its occupation of Palestine and its holding of Palestine within an exclusively British sphere after the war. So these sort of propaganda calculations weighed very heavily on British decision-making as sort of the fate of Palestine was determined.
Interesting. That whole, you know, the early medieval crusades, there were many, many different crusades, and history remembers them as being, you know, brutal religious, racial and cultural wars against the indigenous of the Arab lands. Do you think there was a purposeful revival of that crusading spirit that against the non-Christian, non-Western heathens in the implementation of the Balfour Declaration? Sounds like there was.
Well, I mean, I think there was the invocation of themes. There's a very odd sort of dance between racist consciousness and cold imperial strategy. And I think imperial strategists, even the most cynical imperial strategists, when they're looking to manage public opinion, have to work with pre-existing themes.
Sure.
And within the European imagination, this idea of Islam and of the East is a very powerful, invokes very powerful memories.
Yeah.
So I don't think it was exactly a British official aim to pursue crusading in that sense, so much as that was a feature of British politics that was exploited.
Uh-huh.
But an interesting point to remember here is that there's been this talk, in contemporary terms, nowadays, in recent decades, it's very naturalized to talk about Judeo-Christian civilization. But that's a very recent concept, right? It was earlier much more natural for many people to talk about Judeo-Islamic civilization.
Hmm.
And it's worth remembering that the period of the Crusades itself was one in which Jews were viciously attacked as the prelude and accompaniment to the Eastern March of Christian soldiers.
Hmm.
And there is this real sick irony in the way that Jews have been repositioned as a reason for the Christian West to justify warlike policies towards the East. And I think there's real reason to look back at that history and unpack it. This idea of Judeo-Christian civilization has been used and is being used more and more to give a sort of sense of this inclusion of Jews and tolerance to an old imperial tradition. And I think we need to look at that with a lot of criticism.
Well, that is fascinating, sort of being kind of a football being between the Islamic world in the Crusades and being used by the Western imperialists. Wow, yeah, that's been going on a long time. And again, we're talking about the 100th anniversary today, November 2nd, of the Balfour Declaration. Our guest on Keeping Democracy Alive, Dan Freeman Malloy. And in April 1917, American President Woodrow Wilson went to Congress for a declaration of war on Germany. Imagine going to Congress first. What a concept. Yeah, it's in the Constitution, but never mind. He relied on a tremendous propaganda machine led by George Creel's well-funded official committee on public information with a lot of employees. He came up with the reason for America's entry. He had to figure one out into the First World War as to make the world safe for democracy. You say that the British propagandist Bryce, whom we mentioned before, also used such language and that in it was an assumption of white man's burden, racial superiority. How did this manifest itself with the implementation of the Balfour Declaration?
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly a big moment in terms of this idea of democracy. And democracy as a term has this interesting history where for a long time it was considered by elites in the United States and France in what we think of as the main democratic centers. It was associated as this sort of subversive idea. Republicanism wasn't thought to be democratic in any profound sense. So it was a really interesting moment for this, but among the limitations of this democracy, of course, was racism. I mean, Wilson himself was responsible in the Caribbean for some fairly egregious denials of democracy, to say nothing of the irony of Britain presiding over the world's largest empire and the United States presiding over Jim Crow segregation, talking about their democratic credentials.
Yeah.
Again, though, so, I mean, to answer your question directly, the people of the region had no say in any of this.
Right.
There's a quote not long after the Balfour Declaration by Balfour himself, where he said rather dismissively that they hadn't even gone through the form of consulting the local inhabitants, which they kind of pretended to do sometimes. In this case, he said the great powers have decided to support Zionism for reasons that are just of profounder import than the desires and prejudices of the 750,000 Arabs who now inhabit that ancient land.
Right.
And this idea that, you know, the natives be damned, they're not to be consulted and they're not of much interest anyway, just sort of again speaks to the imperial racism and the contempt for people's self-governance that characterized Western decision making at the time.
Oh yeah, and there was, it seems to me that there was a general sense that, well, maybe someday those people will be ready to govern themselves, but they're not ready yet. They have to be treated like children. We have to guide them. They don't know enough. We have to do it for them. And again, maybe someday, by copying and learning from the British, they'll be able to govern themselves. just a tad racist. In February,
and just to underscore it briefly, though, it also, one line that the British would sometimes use was that the popular support that allowed the sort of mandate, again, they really relied on the World Zionist Organization's support for Britain to hold Palestine, because Britain had pledged support for the World Zionist Organization as a rationale for holding Palestine. We shouldn't, though, be left with the impression that this was some democratic Jewish decision from anywhere in particular either. This came from British imperial corridors of power. Incidentally, the one Jewish member of the British cabinet at the time, Edwin Montague, expressed his vehement opposition to the Balfour Declaration and to the idea of Zionism. And again, this was a period in every major Jewish population center where Zionism was a minority opinion, and whether it was on the socialist left or even at the level of Jewish elites, there was not much acceptance of Zionism. So, again, just that this wasn't by Jewish initiative either. This really was an imperial moment, first and foremost.
Interesting, and it seems to me that in the mid-20th century and beyond, American Jews who were leaning away from the traditions, the keeping kosher, things like that, the one thing that they could identify to be Jewish was big support for the State of Israel. And it's amazing how things change, because, as you say, it was a minority opinion back then when it was created. And then, you know, history changes things. It just does.
It's precisely the same dynamic. So what happened in Britain after the Balfour Declaration and throughout the British Empire was Jews who had previously not been especially supportive of Zionism or interested in it were often drawn into support for Zionism on the grounds that if you want to be a British patriot, it was called patriotic Zionism.
Hmm.
The logic of being a British patriot means supporting Zionist policy in an era where the British Empire has pledged its support for Zionist policy. Now, in the United States, this was equally, if not more, dramatic after the extraordinary explosion of U.S. support for Israel in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier, it was a more complicated story, but since 1967, it has not been some. It hasn't been like American Jews who wanted to support Israel have gone out on a limb to express a specifically Jewish communal attachment. Rather, it's been the case that to support Israel has been a marker of support for U.S. power in the Middle East. And it's that powerful fusion of U.S. patriotic and imperial politics, much more than Jewish communal identification in any narrow sense, that has propelled Zionism to its current position in American Jewish politics.
Yeah, fascinating. I mean, some of the biggest and most vehement supporters of the State of Israel are the right-wing Republicans, who see it as part of some apocalyptic vision and it's, you know, the West versus the heathens, the, you know, very much crusade-like. And it's not so much Jewish stuff, but they support it as an outpost of Western values in that area, and we have to fight those awful Islamic people. And getting back to the...
Absolutely, and where we have to be very, very careful is one of the advantages for Western racists nowadays who want to pursue policies of conquest and racism to the Arab and Muslim peoples is to emphasize this Judeo-Christian idea,
right.
Emphasize Israel, because it seems somehow tolerant. There's this sick and twisted way in which it's almost as if, to atone for the history of anti-Semitism, they're able to construct the colonized people whom they wish to crush as anti-Semites and haters of Israel, and then don the mantle of tolerance as they pursue vicious imperial policies.
Wow.
So people who are actually concerned with anti-Semitism as a form of racism, people who are concerned with thinking consistently about an anti-racist politics, really need to reject as thoroughly as they can this whole idea of a new anti-Semitism where people are questioning Western power and Israel, and really that's just an intolerance against American and Jewish values. It's a really sick and twisted propaganda technique to try to enlist liberal people of conscience in supporting imperial and racist policies in the Middle East.
Interesting and important observation you make there, Dan Freeman Malloy. And again, this was in World War One, and the British were reeling at the time from the Gallipoli campaign. In February 1915, they tried to take, against the Ottoman Empire, the peninsula known as Gallipoli. It was a total disaster. The campaign cost the Allies about 140,000 lives and wounded, and the Ottomans, the Turks, lost about 195,000. Gallipoli proved to be the Turks' greatest victory of the war. Nearly 2 years later, of course, came the Balfour Declaration. In this World War One context, what was the British interest in creating a homeland for the Jews? Tell us about the propaganda value of the declaration in turning up the heat on the British war effort to the east, namely the sick man, the Ottoman Empire, because they had taken a real beating there. And I mean, it was just tragic. The commanders there just forced the underlings, especially the Anzac troops, the people from Australia and New Zealand, over the top, and huge suicide missions. So the war effort, I can't help but think, in formerly Great Britain, took a big hit when that happened. So this was the Balfour Declaration was sort of handy, I would think, in a propaganda way to reestablish public support for the war effort.
Yeah. Now, in terms of talking through the interests, I mean, I think a plausible case could be made that the Jewish national home policy was not a particularly effective British ploy or British strategy when you take everything into account and look at long-term interests. The themes, though, so it's really a question, there's almost a separate discussion of, in cold terms, whether one judges this to be a sort of intelligent, cynical, imperial ploy or one that backfired.
Yeah.
I think the point, though, is really just to think about the themes, especially those that we continue to live with, that this reflected. Now, one theme certainly was this idea, again, that you could have this loyal outpost of settlers in this territory that would link themselves to the home country. It's really hard to know and to identify where that argument was being deployed ideologically as something people were familiar with versus as a genuine geopolitical strategy. There were, though, many arguments along those lines saying, this is what we've been able to accomplish. So with the British Empire, again, there were different kinds of colonies. Two major distinctions were sort of dependent and separate colonies. These were years of profound racism, and the idea was that there are some peoples who we judge as racially unfit to govern themselves,
right,
and who can only be governed by the home country.
Right.
So a major instance, I mean, throughout Africa, throughout Asia, you would have the example, the overwhelmingly important example of India, where it was ruled effectively by British administrators. On the other hand, there were settler colonies. Colonies like Canada, like Australia, like New Zealand, which were actually settled by those considered racially British, and then in some way, for British racists, had a much more privileged relationship with the home country, and it wouldn't be appropriate to send Brits from the home country to suppress Brits from Brits
true.
In New Zealand or in Canada in the way that you would attack Africans or Asians. And these were considered partners of a different kind in a very racialized imperial system. There was then this argument that all we would be able to create in the Middle East with Arabs are these dependent colonies where the population hates us. What we could do if we import a Jewish population that relies only on British power for its survival in the Middle East is create these dependent and thus dependable allies who could work with British power. So that was a theme. I think the most coherent strategic advantage, though, that came to the British by supporting the Zionist movement was they, in so doing, gained a rationale for outflanking France diplomatically.
Mm.
The question of who was going to hold Palestine after the war was a contentious one.
Oh, yeah.
And had it not been at the Paris Peace Conference for this convergence of interest between the Zionist idea and the Zionist movement on the one hand, and on the other hand, British imperial ambitions in Palestine, it's very difficult to see how British imperial officials could have justified holding the country.
Yeah, and France had Syria. That was theirs, and there was a fairly intense competition between France and Britain in that particular area. And before reading your essay on the subject, the Balfour Declaration at 100, I had not heard of the Aliens Act of 1905. This was a British law that had to do with Jewish immigration into the United Kingdom. Now, after the terrorist acts against Jews in France in recent years, I wonder if you could please say more about this and how it influenced British policy in the creation of a homeland for the Jews in Palestine.
Well, so this was really, again, the context for this whole thing was created by two broad realities. One of these realities was Europe's sustained conquest of most of the globe. The other context was the worsening of the Jewish crisis in Europe.
Right.
And essentially, in Canada, certainly in the United States, much of the Jewish population here came here through a mass migration that began in sort of the 1870s, especially the 1880s,
right,
and continued through to the imposition of anti-Semitic immigration regulations in the early 20th century.
Right.
And it was this mass westward immigration of Central and Eastern European Jews.
Right.
And it was in that context that anti-Semitism in France and in Germany really became virulent. And likewise, though the contexts were different, that eventually American and Canadian immigration authorities clamped down on Jewish immigration. Jews at that time were, again, viewed as not the right kind of European.
Mm.
This was still an era of much more narrowly Anglo-Saxon racism before the way that white was constructed in the American or Canadian power structures came to include Jews as comfortably as it tends to today. Now, the Aliens Act
right.
in Britain was the right. first effort to impose, basically targeted at Jews, immigration restrictions to block further Jewish immigration, given that Jews were constructed as these, much as sort of Muslim immigrants are today, as
right.
these sort of backwards, troublesome, subversive security threats who wore their weird clothes and had their weird religious customs and didn't belong in our cities. Now, it was precisely Balfour, then British Prime Minister, who in 1905 imposed the Aliens Act, which was then one of quite a number of West European and sort of Euro-American pieces of legislation to clamp down on Jewish immigration to the West. And certainly the status of Palestine as an alternative outlet for Jewish immigration was one thing that framed support for Zionism from even quite anti-Semitic Western officials.
Which brings me to, there was this white paper you wrote about in 1939 by the British government. It seems to contradict the 1905 Alien Act in a way. This 1939 white paper imposed strict limits on Jewish emigration to Palestine, effectively closing it off to Jews trying to flee Nazi Europe during the Holocaust. What does that say about the real intent of the British governments regarding Israel and anti-Semitism? That's kind of curious.
Well, I don't think it was really that much of a reversal in the sense that you just described, because it's not that it wasn't the case that British Jews were wanting to immigrate to Palestine. Again, there's this, the idea that Jews everywhere would go and live in Palestine
right.
was always rejected by the Jewish communities in the Western countries, effectively.
Mm-hmm.
There are exceptions, but they're very peripheral exceptions. To British Jews, to American Jews, if the Zionist movement had come to American Jews saying, okay, we have this project, which means that you all now have to leave the U.S. because you
right.
don't belong here.
Right.
They tried, and they got laughed or worse out of the room, and there was this very tense negotiation about how to support Zionist colonization in Palestine without then implying that, again, Jews don't have a rightful place in the West. And that that sort of continues to some extent to the present, but certainly into the late 20th century. Now, the Zionist option for Western Jewish communities and for the Zionist leadership to some extent concerned more Central and East European Jews who were then to go to Palestine. The 1939 White Paper resulted from, in part, Arab resistance, right? Now, there was a very awkward situation for the British at the time. What the British were able to claim, with good reason, was that they had established a Jewish national home, whatever that ambiguous phrase means, in Palestine, that they had built up the pre-state Jewish settlement, the Yeshuv in Palestine, to the point where they felt like they had fulfilled their obligations under the Balfour Declaration. The complicated thing at this point, or the fateful fact, was that the Zionist movement had at that point been empowered in Palestine and the Palestinian Arab population repressed to the point that after the Second World War, the Zionist movement was in a position to take control of the entire country effectively and expel most of the native population. The 1939 White Paper was an effort by Britain to sort of dial back its association with the Zionist movement. Now, what had happened in the First World War is the British government had associated itself with Arab aspirations for independence in the Ottoman Empire, saying, okay, our enemy, the Ottoman Empire, rules your territories. How about we have a strategic alliance to, you can rise up against the Ottoman Empire, and we'll promise you independence, a promise that was then violated. The tricky thing, by the time of the Second World War, across the world, really, there was this contradiction where the vast bulk of Third World colonies were held by the so-called democratic allies, right? It was the British, the French, it was the Allied powers and not the Nazis and the Axis that held most of the Third World colonies.
Mm-hmm.
The concern for the British was that if we too brazenly provoke these colonial populations, they might then turn to the enemy. The dynamic that we took advantage of in World War I might come back against us. More specifically, in Palestine, one of the major anti-colonial rebellions of the era had happened from 1936 to 1939, where Palestinians had risen up and really tried to challenge this idea that the country was going to be destined to be a political system from which they were alien. So that was the context for the 1939 White Paper. This is the very, very famous and well-remembered in, let's say, American Zionist memory. There's a funny thing about settlers and about settler colonialism, which is that settlers really like, once they've won, to depict themselves as good anti-imperialists. And it's this real irony of settler colonialism that many of the colonists who are most fierce in their conquest of native territory and their subjugation of native peoples then turn around when the very imperial powers that allowed them to conquer native territory start to limit their power, rebel against the home country, and depict themselves as these sort of anti-colonialists. Frankly, the idea of an American war of independence and the idea of America's anti-colonial origins, where that entirely erases the butchery of native peoples, is a good case, as is Israel's so-called War of Independence in 1948. The idea being that Israel was created in rebellion against the British Empire, a story that totally writes out of the history the native population of the country that was subjugated as part of this War of Independence. So I think this 100th year anniversary of the Balfour Declaration is a good time to move beyond what we've seen Paul Newman enact on the television screen with Exodus and this whole story of Israel as a country founded in revolt against the British, and to remember that it was precisely British imperialism that gave Zionism a foothold in Palestine and paved the way towards the dispossession of the Palestinians.
And it sounds like they tried to back out of it in 1939 and... amazing stuff. I mean, history is always stranger than fiction. One of the things about the Balfour Declaration was the caveat that, quote, nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, end of quote. Was that promise backed up at all by the Brits? What happened to that promise? Why was it there?
Well, it was certainly a violated. It was certainly a violated promise. But this was a tricky. It was a contradictory time. It was sort of a. When we look at this period, it's kind of a transitional period between the period of high imperialism, where white supremacist logic and obvious imperial conquest could be justified more easily, and the period of decolonization. So Britain's and the Allies' expansion into the Middle East during the First World War was in effect, a bringing of new Afro-Asian territories under their influence. It wasn't, though, as easy to proclaim this conquest as at the time of, say, the scramble for Africa. So it's very contradictory. It was no longer considered acceptable to permanently hold native populations in colonial subjugation, or at least to proclaim openly that you're going to do so. So the whole region and the whole era is characterized by two-faced rhetoric about tutelage of colonial peoples towards the part time when they can stand on their own feet and become self-governing peoples, because, as you say, they're now children and they just aren't yet ready. Well, if it was provocative enough for the British or the French to occupy countries and then hold them, saying, yes, some decade in the future we'll give you self-government, but you're just not ready.
Yeah.
In the case of Palestine, to say we're occupying the country, and by the way, there's no room in this country now for the native population, or at least in its political system, would just have not been viable or in keeping with at least the hypocritical imperial spirit of the times. So you had this idea that, well, it's not just that we're going to create a Jewish state here, we're creating a Jewish homeland, and really that won't prejudice the rights of the native population.
So
that was a contradictory and inevitably violated proviso. And while one can't oversimplify things and say that the British did nothing but year by year, month by month, empower the Zionist movement and subjugate the native population, it nonetheless, when one looks at the three-decade-long record, remains the case that the effect of British rule was to weaken Palestinian Arab society, to empower the Zionist movement and its armed forces, and to set the stage for, as you say, the catastrophe of 1948 that saw the wholesale expulsion of a major portion of Palestine's native population.
And they won't forget it. Well, fascinating discussion. So much to learn from history. If people are interested in reading more of your work, Dan Freeman Malloy, is there a website that people can go to?
Yeah, I haven't updated, I suppose, my own, which is notesonhypocrisy.com, in a little while, so people can go there. But the article that I wrote for both Mondo Weiss and then for Race and Class, which if you look up either Mondo Weiss or Race and Class with my name, you'll find easily enough, speak to the topics that we've been discussing.
Thank you so much for shedding light into this amazing bit of history 100 years ago today. Dan Freeman Malloy, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
First thing, the occupation started when Palestine was left brokenhearted. Hands down, you won't believe the way they laid their wrath on her. 6 feet under is where they left us. So bad, the way that they were killing us. Too bad, we're not afraid to die when bombs fall from the sky.
Can't explain.
I never thought that we were gonna lose so bad.
They're all insane.
There's got to be a way.
How can we get back on track? Now, tell me how it's gonna be done. Will we win or lose this one?
Next thing, they're taking
taking all our houses.
Palestine,
ripped from all the corpses.
Tough luck,
they had to have the guns when all we have are rights.
All day,
they're killing little babies.
So we're
defending our families.
They said
that we were out of line.